Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning comic strip artist and cartoonist, creator of Zippy the Pinhead and Nobody's Fool, Bill Griffith. And we're talking about his new book, Three Rocks, the story of Ernie Bushmiller, the man who created Nancy. Bill, welcome to the show. It's always a pleasure to talk about you, about your work, but this book for me just was fantastic. I had read books before about the strip Nancy, but I didn't learn anything about Ernie Bushmiller until I read this book, and that made all the difference in the world.
Well, same for me. Years ago, many years ago, in the early 70s, when I started becoming kind of a fan, an adult fan of Nancy, there was almost no information about Ernie Bushmiller available. There was one book printed, published in the 1940s called Comics and Their Creators, and it had like a 2 or 3 page, I wouldn't call it a bio, it was more or less just kind of a puff piece about Ernie. And that was all I had to go on.
Jeez.
Until 1988, when Brian Walker came out with the Best of Nancy book.
Yeah.
Then there was a little bit more information, but still a lot of holes, you know, a lot of empty spaces. So it took a while for me to get to the critical point where I could actually tackle this as a biography.
Well, it's amazing because you actually dug real deep. You ended up finding out people who hung out with him. And we're able to give you all sorts of interesting insights.
Especially his assistant during the last 12 years of his life, who pretty much was almost a roommate. I mean, he did everything for both Ernie and his wife, Abby, including food shopping. So they became close friends, actually. His name is Jim Carlson. He's still alive. And he lives where he used to live, which is only about a mile from where Ernie used to live. And he went there towards the end of that 12-year period. He was there almost every day. So he took care of business, and he took care of a friendship, and he took care of just day-to-day details. And so there was nothing I could ask him that he didn't have an answer for. You know, at one point I said, what was Ernie's, you know, favorite food? He said, loin lamb chop.
That's right.
No hesitation.
There's that great one page in your book of all of his favorite things, including his cigarettes, which were Kent's.
Kent, that's kind of what did him in, actually.
Yeah.
So when you find out this kind of intimate information about someone's likes and dislikes, you really begin to get a real picture of them.
Yeah.
At one point, Jim would just drop these golden biography bombs at me. At one point, he said, "You know, Ernie was quite wealthy, but he didn't spend much of his money. He had no hobbies, he had no children, and so he did a little bit of playing stock market."
And it's Tootsie Rolls.
And Jim said, when Jim would present Ernie's stock portfolio occasionally to Ernie would say, never sell Tootsie Roll. And I looked it up. Tootsie Roll is a corporation into itself. It is not owned by any major candy corporation. To this day, Tootsie Roll is on the stock exchange. And so that was, like I said, that couldn't have been nicer.
I broke up when I came across that was just, but the thing, first of all, the thing that I take away from your book, one thing I should say, is that he was sort of a nuanced and a lot more complicated person than most people gave him credit for.
Absolutely. He was kind of a wannabe intellectual without a high school degree, you know? So, he was early on in his career. He was part of a group of cartoonists in New York in the 20s and 30s and 40s, all of whom were beginning to be aware that there was an appreciation of their work beyond, you know, the gag that they were pulling every day, beyond the humor that they were delivering. Articles began to appear in academic journals or in magazines saying there was more to comics than it appeared on the surface. it was the beginning of taking comics seriously as an art form. And so Ernie was aware of that, and he liked it. When he was asked how he felt about people who, you know, said part of the Nancy cult, who, this is later in the 60s, how did he feel about those people who were treating Nancy as kind of a, you know, a cult figure and a surrealistic icon? And he just said, the more the merrier.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when the Mad parodies were done, which, by the way, are fantastic, and you reproduce them in your book. I remember those when I came across those as a kid. And he said, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Yeah, I quoted him the Liberace quote. I don't know if you remember. That was a quote that Liberace gave when people would, you know, bring up the fact that he was kind of a kitsch object. He would say, yeah, I'm crying all the way to the bank. Anyway, yeah, Ernie was dimly aware, actually, of underground comics. Because
and that's amazing. That comes out in your book, too. I'm totally surprised.
His assistant, Jim Carlson, in 1969, I think, Jim Carlson was personally curious, so he bought a Zap comic, a Robert Crumb comic, and he brought it into Ernie's house, and he gave it to him and said, what do you think about this? And Ernie looked through it quickly, and then he gave it back, and then he said, it's good. it's good. By which he meant the artwork.
Right.
That's what Jim Carlson later found out. He just meant he appreciated the artwork. He did not want to delve into the subject matter.
Sometimes I felt, reading your book, that he was confounding people. Like their opinions of, there's a quote that you use in the book. I never did anything interesting. I haven't any hobbies. I don't know what you can write about me. So he was like daring people to write a book about him.
Yes. I like to think that this book would have at least not displeased him. So, and I can go by that kind of possible reaction just by Jim Carlson telling me that. Jim said Ernie was waiting for a really good bio. He got a lot. You know, in Ernie's day, even though comics were beginning to attract a kind of intellectual audience, there was still very little of it. And whenever Ernie, his biographical information appeared, it was always kind of trivial and silly. And so he didn't look forward to more of it. And he didn't live long enough to see the real serious stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I could do this. And I wish he had, you know, living relatives that that I could talk to, but he doesn't. I think he has one niece. I'm not sure if she's still alive, but the only information she would give me was that she thought Nancy was the child that Ernie and Abby didn't want to have, that this was their version of having a child, was having a cartoon character. So I couldn't get any more out of her than that. Some people just don't want to have kids, you know?
Yeah, and I understand that, but what I found in the beginning of the book, you quote, Nancy doesn't tell you what it's like to be a child. Nancy tells you what it's like to be a comic strip. And that was pretty on the money. That was, by the time I get to the end of the book, I really, really felt that. I mean, it's a deceptively simple comic that really, really works all the time because of the way he constructed it and the way he drew it. I guess at this point we should explain Three Rocks, why it's called Three Rocks.
Well, in the landscape through which Nancy and Sluggo would walk when they were outside, they were usually on a sidewalk, and behind them was a lawn, and on the lawn, very neatly placed, were perfectly hemispheric three rocks. There was one tree, and on the horizon line, a kind of an anonymous-looking apartment building. And this was Bushmiller land. This was where Ernie and Sluggo operated. And I was always greatly attracted to the Three Rocks, almost like a Zen garden.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were so perfectly placed, so perfectly balanced in the composition of the panels. So, yeah.
I mean, it brings a smile to my face when I look at them. When I look at that sort of minimalist, but it's perfectly balanced. Or you describe it as pristine simplicity. It really is.
Yes. It's kind of the essence in a non-human sense. It's kind of the essence of the strip.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the mystery of the trinity of three things that goes throughout, you know, human endeavors where the two is not quite right, one is a little lonely, but three is just right.
It's three. Yeah.
the threeness of everything, yes.
Well, he was a stickler for consistency for people who filled in. The number of hairs on Nancy's head was counted.
Yeah. Well, Ernie.
Was that true, Bill?
Yeah. Towards the end of his life, Ernie had a couple of assistants, and one of them was a guy who mostly did Superman. So he kind of dreaded working for Ernie because Superman to him was easy. Nancy was hard. To get Nancy perfect, to have the exact perfect shape of her face,
yep,
and then the spikes in the hair. So if he got anything off, anything not quite right, Ernie would call him, you know, in the middle of the night and tell him to redo it. So he dreaded those phone calls. And at one point he was told to make sure that he used 69 hairs, 69 spikes coming out of Nancy's helmet hairdo, because he had done too few. And Ernie said too many would be no good and too few is no good. 69 for the size he was working on, not for all the time. So the number of spikes changed according to the size of Nancy's head. But Ernie counted them. He counted them, yes.
I could imagine him filling in for Ernie, like sweat coming off his brow as he's like, what, one, two,
yeah, right. He had to find a tool to make it look right, too, because he was using the same pens that he was using and the same brushes he was using for Superman. So he found that if he shaved off the end of a fountain pen nib,
wow,
to make it kind of a square end, that would make the perfect spike. So we kept that fountain pen just for the purposes of the spike. Yep.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning comic strip and cartoonist, creator of Zippy the Pinhead and Nobody's Fool, Bill Griffith. And we're talking about his new book, which is just amazing. Three Rocks, the story of Ernie Bushmiller, the man who created Nancy. I want to talk to you about drawing Bushmiller, because I finally got, I really got a sense from him also by your artwork. You knew the kind of ties he was going to wear. You know, there was a certain way that you portrayed him that just sort of summed it all up.
Well, there are not a lot of photographs of him, but there are enough for me through the decades. And Ernie described his own face, his own head, as melon shaped, which had some, you know, truth to it. But I didn't want to caricature him. I wanted to
draw
him the way he really was. You know, in his day, as kind of the same day as my father's day, when you got up in the morning, and if you're going to leave the house, you wore a nice shirt and a jacket and a hat, you know. So that was the era in which he lived. He lived in a world where people were supposed to, you know, dress a certain way and wear certain ties and certain suits, and he did it. He without any conscious decision. It was just something people did. My father used to wear a fedora hat to go get a quart of milk at the corner grocery store.
Yeah.
I like that. I like drawing fashions going back in the decades. And I like, Ernie had some pretty nice 1940s ties.
Yep.
Some loud ties that I'm sure his wife bought him. And he was very well off, but he did, like he said in that quote, he never spent much on himself. His fellow cartoonists, when he moved from the Bronx to Stamford, Connecticut in 1950, when he was well enough off to do that, they all played golf together. Ernie did not play golf. He could have, I suppose. He could have learned and joined with them. He did, you know, join them in parties and drinks and stuff after golf. But his version of golf was to cut a 12-foot swath behind the woods on his property, going back at least 100 or 200 feet. I think he had 7 acres. And through that empty void, he would smash golf balls, one after the other. It never graduated to him buying a bag and playing golf. But I guess when he heard that everybody was playing golf, he thought, well, I'll do it my way. So it's like he was obeying the gag kind of rules of his own comic strip to do that. You know what I mean? It has a nice surreal edge to it too.
It really does. Yeah, and this is why his biography had to be illustrated, because there's a great shot of him. There's a great drawing of him in your book doing a line drive with the golf club right down the forest.
Right. Just through I asked the people who currently live there. Well, actually, I think there's even newer owners of that house. But the previous people, I asked if that 12-foot wide swath was still there, and they looked at me like, actually, it was a phone call. They acted like I was speaking some foreign language. They didn't know what the hell I was talking about. So it all grew back. And it probably grew back shorter.
That's right.
I wondered why there was a short 12-inch swath behind their property. Yeah, Ernie was, few people say he was a recluse. That's not true. He was very sociable, but he was very kind of picky about who he was.
Oh, yeah. And he loved his wife and hung with his wife. But he was often, as portrayed in your book, his mind was often waylaid by ideas for punchlines for his comic. And we got to talk about that, because he worked backwards. In other words, he would come up with some gag, like in his mind, which he called the snapper. And then he worked backwards in order to make that happen.
Exactly. There are other cartoonists who talk about doing that, but not to the degree that he did. So he would come up in his mind with a funny visual, kind of a visual pun. And then he would try to think, okay, that's very funny. It's funny in and of itself, but it's not really a gag until it's a payoff, until it pays off from the previous 2 to 3 panels. So how do I get there? So that became just an exercise in structure. How do you get to the gag that you envision when you've already got the punchline? The punchline is so visual that all you need to do is lead up to it in a way that has its own logic. So, you know, Nancy is on the sidewalk and she sees a partial view of the back of a truck, the side of the truck, and it says, in letters that are half blocked off, it looks like it says atomic bomb. So she freaks out and runs away. Then we go closer to the truck and it backs up and it says, I'm going to lose the gag here. It says something like, how did the word bomb become not a bomb? I can't remember now. Tomo Bombero Furniture Company. Right. So what freaked her out, she thought there was an atomic bomb about to go off in a truck in front of her. When it's revealed what it is, it's actually just the lettering on the side of a truck that read that because of her angle. There was another one where she...
Where Sluggo has a... in the final panel has a big, huge gun. And so...
It's a water pistol.
It's a water pistol. And he's got to figure out, well, how did that gun come about? And it's got to do with a steamroller.
So in the final panel, Sluggo is holding an enormous water pistol, like 40 times the size of a real water pistol. And he's looking surprised. So then you go back and you find from the beginning, you see an old-fashioned, they still have them. They look similar today. They're called steamrollers. They were then. Now there's no steam anymore. But they're these giant rolling, you know, devices that flatten out the roadways. You know, and once they've been paved, so one comes towards him, and the water pistol gets squished by the steamroller, and that was what made it, you know, 50 times size. So once again, this is not logical. In the sense of real world rules, and in the real world, that water pistol would have just been crushed because it was made out of plastic. But in Ernie's surrealistic payoff image, it gets magnified 100 times.
It's got to be the perfect gag. That's what he was always looking for, the perfect gag. I couldn't help but think about you and Zippy, because your strip is so weirdly surrealist that there's not the same kind. But have you ever done anything like that, where you came up with the end panel first and then worked towards it?
Yes, not quite as mechanically.
No.
But no, I often, when I sit down to do a Zippy strip, I don't know, it's kind of a weird little process where I close out everything around me except what I'm about to do, you know, just mentally close everything down. And I basically ask Zippy to tell me what to do.
Yep.
And he often tells me in terms of an image or an outburst, like some kind of fixation on a series of words. So that's where the strip will start, and I do have to work. I have to work it so that what Zippy just told me isn't so surreal that it's untethered completely from reality.
It gets close, Bill. It gets close.
Well, Zippy works best for me when he bounces off of reality, not when he bends reality. He does bend it occasionally, but he mostly bounces off it and reacts to it like a straight man. You know, Zippy is used to be these comedy teams like Abbott and Costello in the 50s. So Abbott was the straight man and Costello was the goofy guy that delivered the punchline. So that's kind of the way it is with my strip. Griffey is the sort of stand-in character for me. And he's kind of opinionated and insecure and cranky.
Yeah, you're definitely the Bud Abbott guy in there.
Yeah, and so Zippy needs Griffey to make people laugh. I remember years ago when I was doing Zippy before I inserted myself into the strip. This is in the early 70s. And Art Spiegelman once said, he said, you know, Bill, I really like the Zippy character, but if you'll pardon the analogy, it's a little bit like being stuck in an elevator with a crazy person. And you're looking at the floor, the little numbers on the elevator, waiting for your floor to happen, because you're kind of anxious to get out of the elevator, you know, before something weird really happens. And I remember when I laughed and I thought it was just funny, but I went home that night and I said, oh my God, I think I've reached a dead end with Zippy. What am I going to do?
Well,
created the Griffey character.
The great thing about Three Rocks is that you're able to insert yourself into the story, especially in the entirely imaginary Bushmiller Museum of Comic Art, which now I wish that museum was not imaginary, now that you've put that out there. And now I got to ask you, are you a docent or a curator at that museum?
I'm a docent.
Okay, good, because I've been a docent in an art museum here too. And it's amazing. You're able to then insert yourself for the sort of highfalutin, high thoughts about Nancy.
Yeah.
And I love that. That works
Sometimes to the dislike of some of the people that I'm speaking to in the museum, because they say, now you're spoiling it. We thought it was just a strip about having fun. So, you know, I get that in too. I get to be self-critical as well.
Now, there's so much about his life that we're running out of time, but I got to ask you about and you address this in the book, the Fritzy Ritz thing. I never understood until you, and thank God you start talking about it, because here you have this like pinup art in the middle of Nancy, and it's jarring.
It is jarring. Without Fritzy, there would be something missing, you know.
Well, she's
the parental figure to Nancy.
She's also the anchor of reality, isn't she?
In her own way.
Yeah.
Her own pinup girl. See, Bushmiller inherited a strip called Fritzy Ritz in 1925.
And that was good girl art. Like.
That was all. It was about this character, Fritzy, who was at that time maybe in her 20s, kind of a flapper kind of a character, and very independent. She had a string of boyfriends. She wasn't interested in marriage or children. She had lots of adventures. She went to Hollywood. She was in movies. Anyway, the guy that did the strip left the strip for greener pastures, and Ernie took it over just by chance. He was 19 years old.
Wow.
So he had to keep doing Fritzy. So if after 8 years of Fritzy, he decided this was coming to a dead end, and Fritzy was kind of a dated character. So he brought in Nancy as a niece. And Nancy, within 3 years, Nancy took over the strip, and it began to be called Nancy instead of Fritzy. But Fritzy was retained. And I imagine a scene in the book in which Ernie is having a meeting with the syndicate head, the syndicate that ran the Nancy strip, in which the syndicate is, you know, complimenting him, saying what a great strip he's doing, and it's got 500 newspapers. But there's one thing I want to stress. And Ernie's kind of nervous. What is he going to say? He says, you know, Fritzy adds sex to the strip, and I wouldn't want you to leave that out. So Ernie was given a job to keep Fritzy in for the male gaze, literally. And if you look at really the comic book version of Nancy, Fritzy is fully sexualized.
Right.
Not, you know, in our X-rated terms, but even more so than you would see in when she's with Nancy. She had a boyfriend who was this kind of nerdy guy.
Oh, yeah.
His name was Phil Fumble. He looked suspiciously like Ernie. And I did a whole chapter in the book where I say the persistence of cheesecake in Fritzy Ritz. Like, what's that all about?
You can't
not address that topic.
There's so much more in this book, and we have run out of time. I just want to mention that the end of the book is worth the price of admission alone. That just had me amazed. My guest tonight is award-winning comic strip artist and cartoonist, creator of Zippy the Pinhead and books like Nobody's Fool. A Harvey Award Hall of Famer. Congratulations, Bill.
Thank you, Mark.
Griffith, and we're talking about his new book. It is amazing. Three Rocks, the story of Ernie Bushmiller, the man who created Nancy. Bill, it's been a pleasure.
Great talking to you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.